Blog Talk Radio.
Audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Now, we've got a good sign that we won't have the same glitch this week as last week. It's quite possible we'll have a different glitch, but the good sign is this, that it's counting down 1 hour as opposed to, what was it, like 24
hours last week, yeah. For those who listened to our show live or even who caught the recording, which I subsequently edited to give a little explanation of why it ended so abruptly, Blog Talk Radio last week took our 60-minute show, turned it into a 24-hour show, which then ran for about 48 minutes for reasons that we can't even begin to glean, but we're pushing on tonight, and we assume that with it saying it's going to be a 60-minute show, that tonight we'll actually get a 60-minute show out of the deal.
That's right. It was said in the chat room afterwards, and that was, by the way, was kind of fun. You know, it seemed like most of the people in the chat stuck around for that additional 15 minutes just to chat back and forth, which is something we obviously can't do while we're doing the show.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know what? It is. It's saying 24 hours, 57 minutes remaining. It says that right now on mine.
Gosh. Well, I'm looking at 57 on my clock here, so no 24-hour business. So hopefully we'll get the full hour in. We'll see.
Now, Jeff says he had to use the Lego version of us to finish for the last 10 minutes last week. So that's the only way to finish that. Jeff, if you could share JPEGs of the Lego versions of us, we would love to see those. I haven't seen the new ones.
Yeah.
I've only got the old ones. I'd like to see, you know, the new ones have more color and stuff. And speaking of new stuff, Big technology announcement today, Stephen. What's going on?
Yeah, the iPhone 5 is out, and big fan of the iPhone here. You know, and I think you are too, Phil. I think you just recently purchased a phone, and so let's rib you just a little bit. What version of the phone did you buy? Like what, last week?
Well, I was given for my birthday. Actually, I should point out I didn't buy it.
Then I should shut up. Then that's
so you give my wife a hard time, not me.
I'm not going to give Ryan a hard time.
It's an iPhone 4S. So yes, okay. I got the 4S on the 31st of August, and now here on September 12th, the 5 arrives. So that's my version of being an early adopter, right there.
That's right.
I let them work the kinks out. I probably should have waited those additional 13 days, and I bet the 4S price has now, like, gone through the floor, right, probably.
Right. It always does. It'll drop by $50, $100 at least. And it's, you know, it's just a cool phone. I'm talking on a 4 right now, and, you know, it's
– Oh, not a 4S? Excuse me. I'm sorry. It's just a 4.
Just a 4, right?
Oh,
now. But hey,
okay then.
I
so right now of the two of us.
Yes, that's right.
I have the more advanced iPhone. Is that correct?
That is correct. Right now, okay. You know, if you wanted to talk to Siri, you sure could do so. She could be part of the show right now.
I could bring her on, but sometimes she's a little shy.
That's right.
She and I, we spend a lot of time alone together, and I don't know, if, you know, if she's ready for. She's not ready for the big one. We should have her on. We've had Ramona on. We should have Siri on one of these. Well, speaking of Siri, now you were telling me before the show started that she played a role in the big announcement today.
Yeah, she. They had the big announcement at Apple, and the kids and I gathered around YouTube and watched it when I got home from work. And it was fun. They she warmed up the crowd. It was Siri warming up the crowd, and it was funny because comedic timing is absolutely essential for a human to be funny, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but Siri actually has no timing at all. Every word is kind of out of, you know, sync, mm-hmm. and you don't, you know, and it made it more funny. Her, you know, her silly jokes that she was doing, and then it would be followed up by the iPad was sitting right next to her, doing like, you know, the garage band going with, you know, ta-toom-tsh, you know, when,
right.
during the room shot, whenever Siri did a joke, she says, I'm excited about the new Samsung coming out. Refrigerator, you know. Yeah, I had some fun jokes and stuff to warm up the crowd. But, yeah, they spent a good hour after, you know, after that just talking about the new stuff that's in the iPhone 5. It's going to be a major, you know, when it goes from 4 to like 4S or from 3 to 3S, there's some incremental changes. But when it goes to the new numbers, seems like they feel compelled to really pull out all the stops to do more to earn the new number.
Plus,
and,
5 is a bigger number than 4 was. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's
by exactly 1. And
yeah.
So maybe, you know,
well, but I mean, it's a bigger, you know, it's just a bigger sounding
yeah,
number.
Yeah.
Like the
yeah,
7 absolutely. Would sound bigger than the 5 to me. The, you know, I don't know. Anyway, than like the 6, right? Anyway. They go ahead.
That's
I mean,
right.
They are bigger. You know what I'm saying, though, that just from a marketing standpoint, some numbers carry a little more clout. I mean, as Sally was saying in the chat room, it has a 5 after it. A 5, right? It sounds it sounds
well,
big. So what's the,
know,
what's the big headline here with the iPhone 5?
The headline is, for the first time, the size of the screen on the iPhone has changed. It is now, instead of being 3.5-inch screen, that's the diagonal measurement from one corner to the other is 3.5, and it has been since the iPhone 1, okay? Now it's 4, and in a 16:9 aspect ratio. And of course, it's a Retina display, just like the two previous versions, 4 and 4S are, but it's a bigger, and just more real estate to do more on the phone. For example, when you turn the calendar sideways on the present 4 or 4S, it'll show you it'll go from the week or the month schedule on your calendar to giving you like the days of the week and the appointments you have on that day.
Mm-hmm.
But when you turn it sideways on the iPhone 5, it shows you a full 5-day work week. There's enough space now to give
cool.
you all 5 days, and you know, and it has like major it's now a 8-megapixel camera on the iPhone, and what else can I tell you? It's they have this cool panoramic feature where you just kind of you pan around yourself, and it'll make a large panoramic 24-megapixel picture. It'll piece it together. Just lots of cool stuff like that. And I mean, it literally went on for an hour with it. And so I highly recommend we ought to get the link to that and put it up in the chat room, because that's something our audience would probably like to see.
Yeah, it's big technology news there. It'll be interesting to track the reception that the iPhone 5 gets. My guess is, let me just go way out on a limb here and say it's going to be huge. That people are going to love it, and it's going to be a big hit. You know, that's going against the grain saying that about an Apple product. I realize, but I don't think it's going to be another Newton. Let me just there I said it. Okay, I think it's.
I think that's a safe bet. It'll do fine. It'll do fine. You posted something on Facebook today. I think that was Phil. That I thought that you knew about the launching of the iPhone 5 because what you posted on Facebook. It showed a stormtrooper, and the stormtrooper is holding an iPhone, and it says, "Bought the iPhone because I couldn't find looking for." So
I couldn't find the droid he was looking for. Yes, and I had I had added the caption, "Move along, move along." For you know,
see, I thought
for those way inside
today, even before.
No, I saw that somebody else was passing that along. Actually, whose picture was it? Memo Lane. Memo Lane originally posted that, and I shared it because I thought it was awesome. Couldn't find the droid he was looking for. Now, this is interesting because we were talking before the show started. It looks like, you know, Samsung has been making some big moves on the droid architecture, and I believe I read recently that they now have the number one selling smartphone in the world, that they are, in fact, outselling the iPhone currently. We'll see if the 5 enables Apple to reclaim the title. But it's very interesting to see Apple getting some pressure.
Phil, actually the iPhone probably beats out the various droids in the United States. But
worldwide.
But worldwide, Android phones are beating pretty well. It's I don't know. Maybe it's just seen as a premium product, and Americans go for that. I don't know what. You know, why that is, that droids would do better overseas than they do in the United States. But that's, I think that seems to be the case.
Well, it could be that it's a price factor. And there is this, I don't know, mystique around the iPhone platform there, you know, and just around Apple generally, that maybe doesn't carry over quite as well elsewhere in the world. We have it, you know, we feel it, maybe in a way that in other countries they don't. It's kind of it's almost a cultural American thing. Although Apple products are well loved elsewhere in the world, I think maybe not to the same extent. If there is a less expensive option in a lot of parts of the world, people will go for go for something that's going to deliver them 80-90% of the experience. Or as some people are saying now with Samsung, you're actually with some of these implementations of Droid, you're getting a lot of stuff that you don't get with the iPhone, although you're not getting some of the stuff that you do get with the iPhone, and then you get into these interesting religious wars. But all I was going to say was I think it's probably good for Apple, and it's good for the market that it's getting competition. I mean, serious competition from other players, both in
iPhone. I don't know if it's good for Apple, but certainly, you know, that Apple has to stay on its toes, and because it's got – there's actually there are actually people now that are producing smartphones that are, you know, not just behind. Like, it seemed like, you know, back when it was the 4, when the 4 was rolling out, it seemed like, good grief, is the rest of the world ever going to be able to catch up to Apple? You know, I mean,
right.
Everything was 5 years behind Apple back then. Now, I mean, it seems like a lot of ground's been covered by their competition, and that's only good. That's helpful.
Absolutely, absolutely, and we see the same thing happening with the iPad and the new Kindles out, and Google has a tablet that's giving Apple some heat. So it'll be interesting to keep tracking all this, and I can't wait to hear you give your full report on your new iPhone 5 as soon as you get one. Probably what, later this week, or
I think
Stephen is calling from the line at his Apple store, I believe, actually this evening.
That's right. I think next month will be soon enough. My birthday rolls around next month, and this is just a hint. Any family members that might be listening, you know, that would be really cool.
Daddy wants an iPhone, guys. Okay. hope everybody's got that. Okay, great. Hey, speaking of birthdays, boy, doesn't that just swing it back around? So last week, when we were so rudely interrupted, we were talking about an idea that had been inspired by my birthday, which was what are we going to do with our next 25, 50, or 100 years, and we actually got through most of our plans for that period of time. We were actually in the process of talking about what to do in 100 years when we were so rudely interrupted by the show stopping. But, Stephen, you had just made the case that one might take a trip and explore the solar system, and we talked a little bit about what that might mean, maybe spending some time on Venus, maybe spending some time out in the Oort cloud. We talked about different ways one might explore the solar system, and I had made the counter argument that in fact, in 100 years, if we're ready to be fully uploaded, we're ready to start actually exploring the whole universe, because you can send a version of yourself, right, a copy of yourself, in a much smaller, more compact kind of spacecraft, a von Neumann Coke can kind of a space probe, and you're ready to hit the universe at that point. But I think between those two, that kind of single idea, did we have anything else that we can do in the next 100 years? Did I miss it? Did we miss something that you had?
Well, let me add to your idea of the von Neumann probes.
Okay.
Certainly, you could send like a whole city in a Coke can, right? To the next solar system or something. I think that it might even get better than that because the Coke can only go at a substantial fraction of the speed of light. Correct? I mean, it's you can't get it to the speed of light. But you could set in the next solar system and say it's the Alpha Centauri system. They set up the infrastructure. Once you got the Coke can arriving, you send out your little nanobots. You build the infrastructure for basically a large reception to allow people to travel at the speed of light or close to it by cells in the form of radio waves to Alpha Centauri from this solar system. So once you have, you send the von Neumann probe ahead, you build your transmitter, and then you get to travel. Once those receivers and transmitters are set up in every system, you can travel roughly the speed of light from one system to the next. So anyway, that might be something for 100 years out.
That's, yeah, exactly. Within 100 years, given some good artificial intelligence, some good miniaturization, some good nanotech technology coming online, that is something that we could potentially make happen. And you really are exploring the universe at that point. I mean, whether you as an how much of the universe you as an individual are going to see would depend on how integrated you become with the project to begin with. But that one initial Coke can, and we call it a Coke can, it's a soft drink sized probe, is basically what we're saying, a very small probe that contains vast amounts of information, including encoded versions of tens of thousands, if not more, people. Those will be replicated, and replicated, and spread across not just the galaxy, but ultimately the entire universe. One of the chief arguments for the notion that we're probably alone in the universe, that we don't have any company in the universe, is that if there was anyone else with, 14, 15 billion years old that the universe is now, somebody should have done this by now. And in fact, our solar system should be awash in these these Coke can probes or other evidence of beings who've done that, which may or may not be the case. The truth is, Coke can's not very big, and people might find other interesting things to do besides explore the universe, which leads us to our other possibility within 25, 50, or 100 years that we didn't talk about, which is what happens if the singularity does occur. And so for any of those time frames, 25, 50, or 100 years, what are you going to do with your time if the singularity occurs? And, of course, the short answer to that is we don't know, because you don't know what's going to happen past the singularity. That's kind of how it got its name. But we can safely say anything and everything you can imagine can occur at that point.
And let me just throw this out. I would think that it's a pretty safe bet that we'll be spending a lot of time in virtual worlds of our own design. We'll design various virtual worlds. We'll visit each other's virtual worlds. We'll build giant communal virtual worlds, fun, interesting places, places where we get work done, places where we play. Maybe that's the reason we haven't seen anybody else show up. People are they get to a certain point in their development, and rather than explore the stars, they just explore inner space that way. So the outer space. So I don't know. Maybe that has been put out there as a possibility. I'm not sure how that really answers it, but.
The thing is, it's entirely possible that once you reach that beyond human level of understanding, level of intelligence, you find some way to do vast computing within the quantum foam or down at the femto level or, in the Planck space. And you've got all the power you need and all the computing cycles you need, and you can just start building universes. So who cares about exploring this one? You've got an infinite number of universes to create and explore on your own, working your way down smaller or working your way deeper into the fabric of space or working your way out of this universe completely and into another one. We just don't know. Once you're post-singularity, anything can happen. And what can happen in 100 years? Anything. I mean, as Michael Anisimov put it a while back, we may never reach the 22nd century because we'll be zipping along at a million times our current rate of processing post-upload. That's not even post-singularity. And subjective time will be slow to the point that, the passage of time until we get to the 22nd century will just be immensely enormous.
Yeah. Eons.
Yeah. Almost beyond comprehension. Well, beyond comprehension to us. To our post-singularity selves, it'll be like, no, I get it. You know. but you know how those guys are. Yeah. They're big show-offs. Okay, so I think, and did I miss anything? I didn't want to rush through that, but
I think that pretty much covered it. That I was going to make for sure.
Okay, good. So I think we provided a pretty good list. Certainly not exhaustive. I think probably people have a lot of additional great ideas about what you could do in each of those time periods. But the other thing that we wanted to talk about was, okay, what if you don't live that long? Right? As I was saying, I'm a pretty good bet for 25 more years, a very shaky bet for 50 more. This is assuming no major breakthroughs in life extension, and a certain bet not to make it 100 at this point. So I won't make at least one of those three, and I think everyone listening is probably not, statistically unlikely to make all three of them. You know, if we've got any one-year-olds listening, they might have a fair chance of making it to 101, but mine have already gone to bed, so I don't know if
they're in trouble. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'd be pretty proud if they were staying up to listen to the show. I'm not sure that'd be mad. So if you don't make it, what options, what possibilities exist for you? Well, we know that there are traditional answers to that around the afterlife or lack thereof. So, lack thereof answer to that question would be none in the context of afterlife, and the afterlife answer would be, depending on the tradition that you come from or that you hold to, possibly that you will be resurrected someday, possibly that you will go to heaven or elsewhere, or possibly that you'll be reincarnated, that you'll show up again on Earth in a different form. That's a traditional solution, and we won't address that directly, although we have talked about it a couple of times over the last three shows, because it keeps coming up in our discussions with first with Julia Prisco and then with Jim Eldridge, the notion that there might be something going on with our consciousness outside of our brains, that it might be residing elsewhere. So we're going to look at that just a little bit in terms of that being a possibility. Before we get to that one, I wanted to talk about this story that ran over on the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology. Stephen, I think we talked about this last week before the show, but we didn't get to the show. Didn't get to the subject on the show. Please donate to the Venturist Society to save a life. Did we talk about this last week?
You mentioned it just briefly at the beginning of the show with every intention to hit it at the end again. And, of course, we didn't get that opportunity. So.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm hitting it now. And this was actually written by Julio Prisco. So you see how this all ties together. The piece starts out, Kim Suzy is 23 and about to die from a fatal brain tumor. She has already lived far longer than expectations. Kim is seeking donations to help fund her cryosuspension. The Venturists have created a charitable fund for all donations and almost achieved the funding goal in a week. And this is more than a week ago that he wrote this, so it's entirely possible that this is fully funded. I had donated by the time we had our show last week, but I'll go ahead and put the link up for those who are interested, if they want to learn more about it or if they want to contribute. But there's a nice couple of images of Kim and one video of her thanking folks for helping her out. But this is a new thing, I think. Cryonics, not new. The idea of someone being cryosuspended is not new. But the idea of people stepping in and saying, here's someone who's about to die, we want to give her another chance. We want to, in a sense, provide her with one technological manifestation of the afterlife. And the idea of people pitching in to raise enough money to provide that opportunity to this young woman, I just was I was deeply moved by this. I thought it was a really wonderful thing that these folks were doing, something to give some peace of mind and some hope to this young woman, and maybe a sign of things to come. Because if this speaks to anything at all to me, it speaks to what Julio talked about a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, which was the effort that transhumanists or posthumans or us after the singularity, however you want to call it, would eventually make to bring everybody back. That preserving our own lives isn't just enough. Extending our own lives isn't enough. That we there would actually be some interest in making that available to everybody who's currently living, and even beyond that, finding some way to go back and get the people who didn't make it. Don't know if that's ever going to be technologically possible, but the fact that people would get together and make an effort for this one individual kind of shows that, yeah, there is a tendency in that direction. At least that was my take. What do you think?
I think it's just awesome what they're doing for this show. It shows a lot of heart, and I'm glad you contributed that, Phil. I have not yet. If it's not fully funded already, I'll do so. That's just a very cool thing. It's a shame we don't have the technology now to cure her without her having to, you know, pass away and then hopefully, you know, be brought back later. But it's just really cool to you know, have this as a potential for her, as a possibility. And so, yeah, very, very cool. But the other question, were you asking me, do you think we'll have the technology?
My question was a little more philosophical. Was do you think that the fact that people are willing to take this step now indicates that, yeah, maybe someday our ancestors or a later version of us might take that bigger step that Julio talked about, which is trying to bring everybody back?
Well, I think if we have the technology, we'll do it. Unless there's, you know, some temporal version of what's the Star Trek thing, Prime Directive, and that keeps people from doing it, you know, I think that we will do it. And what we could learn from, you know, bringing back various historical figures, you know. It was mentioned in the movie AI towards the end. It was kind of a weird ending to that movie. It was an interesting movie, but at the end, I hope I'm not doing too much of a spoiler.
Go ahead. Let's go ahead and spoil AI. Everybody, you've had plenty of time, okay? Or just quit listening for the next minute and a half while Stephen runs the
Fingers in your ears and hum if you need to. But at the end, this robotic child that with the programmed need to be mother, he lived long past the life of his mother, and you know she never really loved him like she was supposed to and everything. So it's a sad, sad situation. And aliens come. After you know humans are gone and they find this little robot channel and they said okay let's allow you to have a beautiful wonderful day with your mother. Now for whatever reason they said the structure of consciousness is written on in the universe and we can give her but it's only good for 24 hours. I think the 24 hour thing is just to create pathos, you know, and
it made it much more poignant. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you only have a day. And it's one this wonderful day, and so that's you know for the purposes of trauma, I understand why they did that. But let me just say this: if you can do it, you can do it for more than 24 hours. It's a silly thing, scientifically. Yeah, there's no you know it's pretty far fetched to be able to do it. But if you can, it'll be.
Assuming
a more
you can, it's really hard to imagine why there would be that particular limit, other than just to make a really sad. Touching thing in a movie, you know.
Yeah, at the end. So anyway, yes, we can, we sure will, Phil. But isn't that the case with just about everything? I mean, if we can do a thing to do it, if there's any utility to it at all, there might have been some people talking about would we actually want to get in a machine and fly around? That would be just too scary for people. Well, once we had the ability to, we did it immediately, you know. So kind of inured to various things. So, yeah, I think we will if it were possible.
Hey, Stephen, we're getting some feedback in the chat room that you're breaking up.
Okay.
You sound okay to me. I don't know if it's static or if you just want to speak a little more forcefully.
I'll see if I can put my mouth a little closer to the receiver. Maybe that'll help.
Yeah, just bark it out there. You know, you remember I'm Carson. You're McMahon. Okay, so you just, you know.
Okay.
wait, more info here. Sally says it's fading in and out. So I don't know if my tips will help or not. But as long as it makes you really self-conscious and hard to do the show, I feel like I've done my part in terms of, you know, passing.
Well, you see, this is because it's an iPhone 4. And family, again, if I had an iPhone 5, these problems will be solved. And so there you are.
Just all the sooner that we need to get you on that platform. Well, it's really interesting when you make that next leap, which is this idea that we've come full circle to, that perhaps our consciousness is not completely tied to the physical structure of our brain. This is what Jim Elvidge made that point a couple of weeks ago, that link is not as well established as we would like it to be, since we don't actually for sure know what consciousness is yet. And, you know, you get into this interesting question of, well, as I said to Jim, where else would it possibly be happening if it's not happening there? And, you know, the answer is that it's happening on some underlying computing infrastructure, although it wouldn't even necessarily have to be happening there. It's possible that it's just that it's just being backed up there. The analogy that I came up with on this is my consciousness like a Microsoft Word document, or is it like a Google Doc, right? Because, if a Microsoft Word document, if my hard disk is destroyed, then I've lost it, right? If I didn't make a backup or something like that, it's gone. But a Google Doc, you know, you can nuke my hard drive and the document's still there. The document can be in several places at once. Several people can be working on it at the same time. It's sitting in more than one place. And that then says that our consciousness is maybe something that can reside in our brains, or maybe it's more like something that can play on it, like the brain is a good player for consciousness. Now, this is all extremely speculative. Do we have any evidence that that's the case? Well, Jim probably could have stepped us through some more. Next time we have him on, we'll talk about what reasons there might be to believe that. But I actually saw when somebody links your blog, you get a trackback. To an old post on The Speculist. It was a reminder that I had put up that we weren't doing Fast Forward Radio the week of August 19th, 2010. And we were talking about the Singularity Summit that had gone on that week. And I made this comment. I said, I was telling a friend about Anita Grohl's rather provocative conclusion to the talk she gave Sunday morning, in which she asked, what if information, consciousness, and mind are something pervasive, more primal, and even more fundamental than matter, energy, or even space-time? Now, at the time she asked that question, even at the Singularity Summit, I never made the connection. It never occurred to me that she was talking about anything other than like a traditional spiritual view. She's an Indian lady, and what I took her to be saying was kind of, you know, she was introducing pantheism or something like that. But when I read over the comment now and I read back over the talk that she gave, I really think that she was actually introducing this idea that perhaps our reality is occurring here in this universe, but it's also occurring sort of in the cloud, that it might be running on some other infrastructure. And if it is, then the possibilities for what happens to us even if we die become much broader and much more expansive. I guess that was a long way of getting to that conclusion. But if that's the case,
you know what?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think physicists would find that, because I mean, the more further down you drill into the universe, the more you find that there's no there. In other words, you know, when you look at, it just turns out that there's just more. There's information down there, but there's not a lot of, you know, there's nothing, you know, rock solid, you know, inside of an atom. You know what I'm saying? It's the nucleus is just a tiny, tiny fraction of the atom itself, and so it's just a lot of empty space. And it's as if it has more to do with information telling the matter how it should act than it is anything solid being there. And
exactly. Yeah.
It's a compelling view. Yep.
It is. Not a lot of evidence for it, so it's not something that that we can say, well, here's the calculations that show that to be the case. But it does line up very nicely with the possibility that we may be living in a simulation of some kind or some kind of artificial construct. And if that's the case, then an awful lot of I'm trying to think of the right word for this, ideas, I don't know, things that were used as dogma in a traditional religious sense, a lot of beliefs gain a new cachet, don't they? I mean, it's like, well, all those ideas become relevant once again. They were always relevant for people who believed in them anyway, but when you go through this whole process, this kind of Tipler process of, I'm an atheist, I reject the idea of religion, I'm a physicist, I'm talking about how the universe might end, I'm talking about the anthropic principle, suddenly I'm talking about how the future humans might build computer simulations that resurrect everyone who's ever lived. Oh, it sounds a lot like Christianity, and I've become a Christian. I'm not saying everyone's going to follow Tipler's arc, but I'm saying a lot of those ideas that that were pushed out of the discussion because they were spiritual or religious ideas start kind of sneaking back into the discussion. When I asked Julio if what he was saying, his experience would be, didn't sound an awful lot like what a Christian said their experience would be on waking up in the afterlife, he said, yes, it sounds exactly the same. So it's interesting that we can talk about these things and we already sort of have templates, we already have ideas for them, but we're a little hesitant to use them. I think we're a little scared to talk about it in those terms. Primarily out of fear, I guess, of being misunderstood that we're talking about religious ideas when that isn't necessarily the case.
I think it's a bit of a shame that that is the case, because the way I look at it is that when it comes to matters of faith and matters of, say, skepticism, I guess is the opposite side of that, we're not binary. Human beings are not binary on that. It's not like, everybody's either 100% faithful to a particular religion or 100% an atheist. I think that there's a tendency, to pour yourself into one belief system or the other, skepticism or religious or religion. But it seems like there's always going to be a little bit of splashback on the into the if you think of it as two different cups that you can pour yourself into. It seems like you're always going to be on the continuum. You're never 100% one way or the other, whether you're Richard Dawkins or Billy Graham. You're always going to have a toe in the other world.
Yeah, there's kind of a yin yang thing there. So anyway, it's very interesting to consider that. And I'm not giving anyone any guarantee. I'm not saying to anyone, well, if you don't live the next 25 years, don't worry, it's all taken care of.
I think you ought to give a double your money back guarantee, Phil. I really do.
Okay, that I will. Okay. Anyone, for any amount they've paid to listen to Fast Forward Radio tonight, paid to us, I will double that money back. If you're not completely satisfied with the afterlife that I absolutely guarantee you're going to get. So. There.
Yeah, we'll pay you in your whatever
whatever
in
currency
the
exists in the afterlife.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whatever afterlife you find yourself in, we'll find you and pay you back double what you paid us. So
absolutely. Yeah. All right. So I think that covers it then, all the possibilities. If you live, a lot of great things you can do. If you don't live, there might still be some chance that you're going to make it well beyond that next 100 years. So I think with that, and with less time remaining than I thought we would have, let's switch it on over and let's talk about our headline topic of the evening, which is the end of all suffering. This is I'll go ahead and provide this YouTube link in the chat. I believe it was already in the show announcement, but this is a guy named David Pierce. And he outlines for us what it would take to eliminate all suffering in the world. Now, Stephen, I don't know if did you get a chance to listen to his talk?
Yeah, but to be quite honest, Phil, I didn't get all the way through it. Well, you know, I don't want to be negative about him, but my mind drifted. So
I have to say that I think from a presentation standpoint, I would almost always rather read something than have to like watch a YouTube video that doesn't even have any video. It was really just audio, and It's like this guy's face, and they're distorting his face and stuff. And it's just like, please don't present information like that, please. But I did make it to the end, and I like the take that he takes. I mean, because I think the first objection that people will have to the idea of eliminating suffering is that it's a fool's errand. That to talk about eliminating suffering is to chase a mirage. That no matter how great things get, people always seem to manage to be just about equally happy or unhappy with their circumstances. And so the first thing he says, and I think all attempts to achieve universal happiness so far in the world have all failed on exactly those grounds, right? You know, it's like you can do what you want. Poor people are actually reasonably happy, and rich people are actually reasonably miserable. I mean, if you compare, I'll take rich, but given the choice, but there's not this like formula that suddenly bestows happiness on people. There are a lot of prescriptions and a lot of things that different people swear by, but nothing that universally you can say, here, just do this, and everybody is happy. So the first thing that he said that really caught my attention is that changing socioeconomic circumstances won't make it happen. And he acknowledges the fact that there is a happiness set point, that we only seem to be able to get and stay so happy. So if you want to make suffering go away, one of the things that you have to do is start working on that basic infrastructure around how happy we can get. He says that even if everything the futurists ask for happened, you know, all the great stuff we talk about on this show occur, subjectively, people will be no happier than they currently are. So what would work? Oh, I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing. If money can't buy happiness, then is there some way we can rent it?
Well, here you go. Well, we have to change the set point. Okay, so he gives three ideas for how you can do it. One, wireheading. Okay, piping stimuli directly into the pleasure centers of the brain. This will work, but he points out it's not evolutionarily stable. It's not going to promote reproduction. You can aim for super happiness and super intelligence, but it's unclear what kind of society you actually get if everybody's just kind of jacked into their to their pleasure centers.
It wouldn't work for the same reason that if someone were to buy me a lifetime supply of cocaine, it just does not pay to be to just have happiness just beamed into your head. your pleasure centers just are not built for that. I think after a while, it takes more and more stimuli to achieve the same level of happiness.
I don't think that gets it necessarily. Assuming even for a minute that you can, that you can hit some moderately higher level and sustain it and say, yep, just happy all the time, happy.
Yeah.
It would be easier on your body for sure than the cocaine. Because let's face it, a lifetime supply of cocaine isn't as much cocaine as you probably think.
It might be just a month and a half supply, if you think about it.
You probably don't need that. You probably wouldn't take as long as you think. But this you could conceivably, you could go years and years feeling pretty darn happy with a little, little electric current aimed in the aimed in the right direction. But there is this fear of kind of a stagnation, you just sort of bliss out and you're done. Although he does talk about that as well. Could it be modified in such a way that so people could be sort of blissed, but not blissed out? Right. It's like we don't know. There haven't been many attempts to actually make that happen. So how well that
What if it could be fixed to where when we do something that makes us happy, we help somebody else. We spend some time with our kids. That could be amplified in some way. It instead of being happy at level 6 or level 7, all of a sudden we're happy at level 10. When there's reason to be happy, And then when we're sad, maybe that could be diminished in some way. You know,
right.
The, some of the edge could be taken off of that. And we get, so we end up with more happiness and less sadness. And it seems like you could adjust the dials just a little bit, you know.
Well, and actually that's what he closed in on with idea number two, which is utopian designer drugs. And obviously the word utopian and the word drugs have all kinds of red flags that go off. But he's talking about stuff far more sophisticated than what we currently have. Something that could give you lifelong high functioning well being without the unpleasant side effects, without that burnout that we talked about might happen with wireheading or any of those other problems that might occur with the cocaine, for example, being a non-designer, non-utopian kind of a drug. And he says, here we're talking, you know, about solutions that would aim not just for hedonistic contentment, but for, like, larger notions of satisfaction that we have. So we're not just talking about feeling mega good. But we're talking about, you know, what are the things that actually make life seem more meaningful, and how do we enhance those experiences and realistically seek after them and acknowledge those and like kind of incorporate that experience, broaden that experience, and make that experience more nearly the norm, make it more nearly permanent. Still sounds like a tall order for me to achieve with drugs. Right. I'm saying, okay. Well, if there's a pill that will do that, I would take it. But the basic idea is sublime well-being on a sustainable basis. I think you probably get closer to that with his third idea, which is genetic engineering.
Right.
And that is, you know, the way he puts the question is, wouldn't it be better if we were all born wired for optimal well-being? And he talks about the fact that there's a minority of people who are always depressed. And then there's another minority of people you don't hear nearly as much about that have a condition called hyperthymia, I believe. They've got the hedonic set point, as he describes it, the happiness set point, set way up. These are people who are the opposite of depressed. They are just generally happy most of the time. Unhappy circumstances don't seem to throw them off that much. And it's interesting, when you study happier people, you find some interesting things out, that happier people respond better to stimuli than unhappy people. They are healthier. We've talked about optimism and the impact that has on life generally. You know, they're more successful, they do better. All the things
they can
that
learn from mistakes, because a person that's genuinely depressed doesn't feel like there's any point to self-improvement anyway.
That's right.
But an optimistic person can go, okay, that wasn't great. Let's see how I can tweak myself to be better if this circumstance were to arise again. And, you know, and that's so. And then of course it's self-fulfilling, isn't it? Because they are optimistic and they think that they can improve upon their outcome the next time it rolls around. When it does roll around, they do, which makes them more optimistic. It's a virtuous cycle, and better be on that cycle than the opposite, isn't it? Where you just, it's so, you know, my life is crap, and therefore it is crap. You know, it's
given a choice between
you want to be on,
between being a manic depressive and hyperthymic, I'll go with absolutely we'll go with being hyperthymic, from a standpoint of it sounds more fun, and also from a standpoint of it just sounds like you get a better life out of the deal, generally speaking. And you make a good point, because when I said happier people respond better to stimuli, it's true. They respond better to positive stimuli, and they respond better to negative stimuli. There's this old Buddhist, piece of advice, which is maybe it's a commandment. I don't guess Buddhists have commandments per se, but it is to go forth and enjoy the suffering of life, right? Buddhism is all about suffering of life, but they add that interesting word, enjoy. Enjoy the suffering of life. And that's kind of the thing we're talking about. You don't actually eliminate suffering. You change the response to it, And that changes everything. You change the attitude that you have going in and how you're able to respond to it and what you're able to make of it. And it, suddenly it's in a sense as though there were no suffering, but you're actually better than that because you've still got that negative stimulus, which can propel you in a lot of different directions. I mean, if you're just immune to pain, right, if you don't feel it, then you're not going to respond in any particular way that's going to move you away from it or move you in an interesting direction. That's kind of the danger I think you run into with the, you know, jacking into your brain or using drugs. But if you have a very high happiness set point, and if you have stimulus coming in, you're going, I recognize this as a negative stimulus, but I'm still very positively disposed to how I'm going to respond to it. That's the most powerful position to be in, whether it's a positive stimulus or a negative stimulus. So that one starts to sound pretty good. And although he stops with genetic engineering, I would take this to the next level, which is that once we're up in the other substrate, this would be a, I won't say simple matter, but this would be a matter of rewriting some code, right? Rather than rewriting genetic code, we'd be talking about rewriting the code that defines how we feel, how we respond, what our basic attitude is towards life. Now, that's very dangerous because, you know, once you start pulling stuff out or putting stuff in, there's this whole question of, you know, which part of these experiences, which part of these basic aptitudes, which part of these basic attitudes, basic perceptions, basic approaches to things that we have are what really finally ultimately make us human. Right, and which one of these can you just like pop out and suddenly you're not human anymore? But if it's done first at the biological level, genetically, we'll have better code to work with once we're up there in the other substrate. And if it's done experimentally with everybody watching, right? If Stephen, if you do some upgrades, right, to yourself, say we're both living in a you know, post singularity. Computer simulation, we're both completely uploaded, and you say, hey, I'm going to go do some uploads, and you come back from having done the uploads, and I go, man, you're just weird now, right? You're not really even, you're like robot Steven. If humanity overall, right, is participating in the process, participating in the experiment, I think we'd have a pretty good chance of saying, well, I think these are the parameters that we want to stay inside of. We don't want to go outside that. As long as everybody didn't change at once permanently, I think that would be a solvable problem.
Well, you know, I read a story, it's probably been 5 years ago now, about a guy who was, you know, really almost pathologically shy. You know, one of these people that would, you know, if something weren't done to help him, he would pretty much, you know, become a hermit, stay in his house, you know, Emily Dickinson style, where hardly ever leave kind of thing. And so they gave him medicine. I forget what it was or what drug they gave him. Somebody in the chat room might be able to even guess what it is. But anyway, he took it. It basically made a robot out of him. He was able to function quite well to do his job and everything else. But his significant other, wife or girlfriend, told him that she was leaving because he had no emotion at all. He didn't care about anything. He was just a robot now. And he didn't know what in the world she was talking about. And then he said, well, then I stopped taking the drug because I didn't, you know, I didn't want to lose her, so I stopped taking the drug. And he says it was about like day three after stopped taking the drug that here comes emotions come rushing back, you know, all of a sudden, you know. And he said it was a remarkable experience, you know, because the emotions went away gradually, and he didn't realize that was happening to him. And then when they came back, they came rushing back, and it was like, you know, going from Dr. Spock to a human. And he said it was just a remarkable experience. And so what he's done now is he's found the happy medium. You know, he went back on the drug because he needed it to function, but he did it in a much smaller dose, and he found the right dose for him, and it seems to be working both so that he can have emotions and leave the house. So
that's good. You know, you want to be able to do both. It's like if I can't leave the house, if I'm so inhibited that I can't interact with other people. I want to fix that. But, you know, becoming a person who doesn't recognize that something bad is happening when your significant other says they're leaving you, that's not an improvement, is it? I mean, that's just like you've become some other kind of being, right? I mean, I mean, there really is a shift from a normal human response to those circumstances. That's exactly what we're talking about, and that's really not eliminating suffering. That is, it's the old you're masking the symptom, right, rather than actually solving the problem. Because if he was hyperthymic and then his girlfriend says she's going to leave, well, either there's the negative stimulus and he's basically a happy person. He's either going to go, okay, I'm great with that, right? Because come to think of it, it's over between us. Or, wait, I've got all kinds of positive responses and we're going to work this thing out, right? I mean, the happy person's response to that is going to be completely different from the depressed person's response to that. But what you described wasn't even a person's response to that, right?
Yeah.
It's just a sad place to be. Well, just real quick, this fellow David Pierce gives the reasons for why we should do it, and it actually relates to this discussion of depression, which is he says why should we do it? Well, it follows from classic utilitarianism. So if you're a utilitarian, if you're really all about improving the lot of the many, right, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, then this is a logical step in that direction. And he puts a little meat on that bone with the statistic 800,000 people kill themselves every year. So even if you weren't going to try to blanket eliminate all human suffering, if you could cure depression genetically, if you could say, okay, look, we're going to make a tweak here, and instead of being depressed, you're going to be more in the hyperthymic direction. You're going to be, you're just going to be more happy. You save a lot of lives, and you don't dehumanize people by giving them the capacity to be happy, because we know that the capacity to be happy is a normal human trait, and one that I think very highly of. I must say, it's one that I value quite a bit. And I think one that is really intimately tied to our ability to make things happen in this world. So I find myself agreeing with David Pierce that it's a worthy goal, and it will be interesting to see if more people get on board with the project of ending all human suffering.
Absolutely. Well, I think one interesting thing that we got close to talking about here, Phil, was, what about if we have the ability to wire ourselves any way we like, and we just choose to wire ourselves to be better people? We decide to say, you know, I'm going to give myself an emotional just charge. I'm going to wire myself to feel just incredible joy whenever I do something that's completely selfless. Now, you laugh and say, well, that's not selfless anymore then, is it? You get an emotional charge. But let's just say we decide that, you know, the world will be a better place if there are more altruistic people. And so we're going to wire ourselves emotionally to be altruistic. I think, you know, to me, it might be worth the risk. And the risk that you talked about to try an experiment like that.
Ultimately, isn't this, without having any wiring ability, what people are always trying to do anyway, you know? I mean, this is what New Year's resolutions are, right? This is when people go to church, right? When people join a 12-step program, or just when they get up in the morning and say, "Wow, I'm really going to try harder today to not do this or to do that." We're constantly trying to rewire ourselves to be better and happier people. And I think that give us some actual tools to do it, and we're going to push ourselves farther and farther in that direction. Well, we're close on our time, Stephen, so what's our music this evening?
We've did the music that I intended for last week. I know that the link was put up in the chat room, but not everybody heard it. So let's go with Snakes and Ladders by Circus Envy.
All right, Circus Envy with Snakes and Ladders. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and thank you all for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again next week at the regular time. Look forward to talking with you all then. And until then, live to see it.